Hey, climate conscious listeners, this is Greg Dalton. You're listening to the C1 Review, a podcast presenting highlights from some of our past shows. You can check out videos, podcasts, and more at climateone.org.
This is Climate One, a conversation about powering America's future. Today, our host Greg Dalton explores the left-right divide in politics over climate change and action.
Republican elected officials are in a very different place on energy and climate than Republican voters.
Meanwhile, more and more businesses are seeing clean energy as an opportunity, not an imposition.
Used to be about $1,500 a watt to produce lithium-ion batteries. It has gone down, down, down. And when you get below about $300, you can make electric vehicles that will blow away the competition.
Up next on Climate One. Climate One is changing the conversation about America's energy, economy, and environment. I'm Claire Schoen. Climate One conversations with oil companies and environmentalists, Republicans and Democrats, are recorded before a live audience and hosted by Greg Dalton. Today we're talking about the business and politics of climate change. Keeping our economy rolling and workers employed while making the transition to climate-friendly energy sources requires political imagination and industrial innovation. But innovation can also be a bridge between business and politics. With the Paris Agreement now part of our climate landscape, industry leaders need to adapt their business models to respond to the historic promises made by our politicians. Electric cars need a breakthrough in battery technology. Energy conservation requires rethinking how new buildings are designed and old ones retrofitted. To explore these challenges, Greg talked to Lord Nicholas Stern, a former chief economist of the World Bank, and one of the foremost global experts on moving the economy from fossil fuels to cleaner energy, and Steve Wesley, who runs a venture capital firm that made early investments in Tesla and in the biofuel company Omeris. Here's our conversation about innovation in a post-Paris world.
Nick Stern, take us back to Paris. You were there, had a ringside seat. Countries came together. Companies were present. Give us a peek inside Paris, how it came together.
Well, it felt like being in the ring as well as having a ringside seat. The risks, I think, had been gradually understood over time, just how devastating it could be to move to 3 or 4 degrees. I'm talking about centigrade now.
Warming excuses. Since post-industrial times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's average global surface temperature relative to, say, the second half of the 19th century. It's okay to use centigrade on NPR?
Yeah. Americans have a little difficulty, yeah. But they'll deal with
anyway,
it.
Anyway, what I'm saying is that what had changed ahead of Paris was that people had started to understand what the transition looked like. Cities where you can move, cities where you can breathe, ecosystems which have much greater chance of survival and doing much more for you. So for me, the key change was the understanding of the real attractiveness of the alternative route in terms of the way we live and building a much more attractive and more productive way of living.
Steve Wesley, as an investor in Silicon Valley, how did you look at the Paris Agreement as a significant milestone in the move toward clean energy? Was it just politicians talking or was it meaningful?
There's a confluence of two things going on. First, there's a global political movement towards sustainable energy combined with, really for the first time, new generations of breakthroughs in clean technology. And it's happening across the board, whether it's low-cost solar, affordable electric cars, low-cost power storage, which has really been the missing link for solar and wind, to affordable LED lamps. We're heading into a sustainable world. And if you think about it, we're that close to having a world where you may not be having to pay a penny for electricity at home if you buy low-cost solar that's now at parity with carbon fuels. You may not even be paying a penny for gas ever again. And when you're not paying for electricity or gas, wow, that is a whole new world.
Steve, tell us about when you invested in Tesla, what your wife thought about that investment.
Well, yeah, no, I came home and I told my wife, you know, there's this guy, Elon Musk, and, you know, 27 guys in a warehouse in San Carlos, and we're going to revolutionize the global auto industry. And she said, you've lost your mind, go get your money back. And in the early days, it was not at all clear what would happen. But by the time we got to the Model S, people said, wow, it was car of the year, safest car ever made, best performing car, highest reviews from Consumer Reports. It showed people you can make an electric car that's transformative.
Nick Stern, you spend some time in China at the highest levels of government. Tell us what you've seen in terms of EV adoption in China, because the story has been if the middle class in China gets a family car, they fry the earth.
I've been working in China for nearly 30 years. I was at the China Development Forum, which is a very big gathering of senior China economic leaders and the heads of big companies of the world, whether they be Ford Motor Company or Bombardier or DuPont or whatever. So we all go and meet with the premier at the end of that. And he said, you know, the cars essentially that you predominantly make have 5 or 10 years in China. And after that, it's the electric car. And we hope you really participate strongly in this. But I should mention that there are 3 or 4 Chinese firms are moving rather quickly in this direction. And that's a big signal. You know, that's Prime Minister of China to head of the Ford Motor Company. So maybe they'll rise to that challenge.
Steve Wesley, can the American and global auto giants adapt to this? Your response to that?
They're already adapting. And here's what I wanted to throw out. It used to be about $1,500 a watt to produce lithium-ion batteries. It has gone down, down, down. And when you get below about $300, you can make electric vehicles that will blow away the competition. We're getting very close to a point. And LG Chem in Korea is talking about a sub $200 a watt lithium-ion battery. Mr. Musk is building the Gigafactory. Mr. Musk is serious about producing lithium-ion batteries, but this is full-on competition to replace what has been part of the global oil industry, what powers cars. And one of the questions is, Korea going to win, the U.S., Samsung? This is the race to be watching, and I'd submit it's a good race for the health of the planet.
But Nick Stern, cheap oil is going to make that transition hard, because when gas prices are where they are, Americans buy SUVs. Simple as that.
One thing we learned from looking at the history of oil prices is that there's lots of fluctuation and not much trend. And we're going to see them go up and down. But what you learn from looking at renewables is there's a very powerful trend downwards.
We're talking about climate change and clean energy at Climate One. I'm Greg Dalton. My guests are Steve Wesley, former board member at Tesla and former controller of California, and Nicholas Stern, former chief economist at the World Bank and climate expert. There's a debate that rages in the clean energy community about we need big, bold breakthroughs, whether it's fusion or moonshots to discover big new things. And others say, no, if we just fund what we have today, we can do this. Steve Wesley, which one is it?
You want the most cost-effective thing possible. Solar used to cost over $110 a watt. You're just not going to sell a lot at that level. Today, we're at $2 and heading down to $1. That's transforming the world.
Nicholas Stern?
About 40% or more of what we have to do to cut back on our consumption of fossil fuels is energy efficiency. And we always jump quickly to replacing the fossil fuels, and we must. But big part of that story is just using energy much more efficiently than we have in the past. And there's so many ways that we can do that. Designing cities that work, the right combination of public transport and electric cars and cars that link up. And so we have to do in our argumentation much better than simply talking about renewables versus fossil fuels, important though that is, because energy efficiency, the way we organize ourselves in cities, is such a big part of the story.
Steve Wesley, if the economic opportunity is so big, how come a lot of venture investors in Silicon Valley have pulled out of clean tech? They swaggered in and said, hey, we're smart, we'll figure this out, we'll tell you how it's done. They lost some money, and
there's not a lot of money in Silicon Valley going into energy other than some software-type plays, Nest, et cetera. So why is that?
Look, the simple reason is if you look backward, people lost a lot of money because they came in too early. Just like if you saw one of the first mobile phones that weighed 10 pounds and cost $5,000, you'd say, no one's going to buy these crazy things. Fast forward 36 months, the cost goes below $500, the weight drops down below a few ounces, and you sell a billion units. We're in that same point. I used to serve on the board of Tesla. The first car we had, the little Roadster, cost $120,000. I could get in. I couldn't get out. It was dreadful. Now we have a car, $30,000, and it may become the biggest selling car in America. So the key is you look forward, not backward. There's an inflection point in every area of the economy, and I'm here to tell you we're hitting that inflection point in renewables now.
Nick Stern, you wrote a book, Why Are We Waiting? You know, behavioral economics is a big thing recently. So tell us, there's so much information, abundance of facts. Why are we as individuals, as humans and countries, not moving faster when our planet's on fire?
In Paris, the tipping point came where the 195 countries really wanted an agreement. It came when they understood that this is not only possible, it's also very attractive. That argument took a long time to gain traction. I think it's gaining traction now, but we have to demonstrate how it works, that the alternative way of doing things is cheaper, more attractive, more exciting, cities where you can move, cities where you can breathe. That's the key, and we're gradually getting there. It's picking up speed, but we're not going anywhere near fast enough.
Steve Wesley, what are some real exciting areas where you see big breakthroughs, whether it's food, energy, et cetera, efficiency? Where are we going to see some real cool innovation?
People do not realize how much energy is just plain wasted. Over 40% of the energy in this country is used by buildings, more than transportation, more than factories. Our buildings are sieves. You're going to see a revolution in this smart building movement combined with this thing called the Internet of Things, where your home becomes smarter overnight. You will have smart lights that go on and off. You will have smart windows that you can control with your smartphone. Keep an eye on a firm called View Glass. It is a transforming thing. So a lot going on in the smart building movement.
Let's go to audience questions. Welcome to Climate One.
Hi, my name is Wayne. I'm with 350.org. There's a website, trillionthton, T-O-N-N-E.org, which basically tracks how much carbon dioxide we've added into the atmosphere. Roughly 600 gigatons up to now, and roughly 1,000 gigatons is all we can add. And after that, we have to go to zero carbon. I am concerned about how little time there is left for us to get off of carbon.
Nicholas Stern, the urgency.
You're absolutely right that the urgency is intense. We have to make virtually all our infrastructure from now on almost entirely clean and sustainable. The good news is that we know how to do that. We're going to have to do that very quickly with things that we know. We're going to have to invest strongly in research and development to develop others. And we're going to have to look after our sinks much better than we do. And the best sinks are in the forests and in the land. And rehabilitating land gives you more land to grow food, and it gives you a place to store carbon. We have to invest in and look after the land and the forests in particular.
Next question. Welcome to Climate One.
Hi, I'm Mary James of Low Carbon Productions. And this question is mostly for Steve about passive building technologies. So I just was wondering if in your investments you're looking at passive building retrofits and how to get us to improve the existing buildings that we have.
Buildings that kind of heat and cool themselves.
There are almost no industries I can think of that have had fewer innovations in the last 100 years than buildings. We're changing that quickly. You will see a revolution in LED lighting, lighting controls, smart windows. Every facet of the home is going to change. It is dramatic. And most all of it will be controlled by your smartphone. They say potentially half the homes in America have water leaks. On your iPhone now, you can tell like that if there's a problem and fix it. You can't fix what you can't measure, and we're providing the analytics to give people that greener lifestyle they want.
Greg Dalton has been talking about innovation and politics with climate economist Lord Nicholas Stern and venture capitalist Steve Wesley. free podcasts of this and other Climate One conversations are available on our website at climateone.org. You're listening to Climate One. You're listening to Climate One with Greg Dalton. America is a divided nation today. We refer to our politics as red and blue, but actually it's a rainbow of positions and perspectives. On the issue of climate change, some of our politicians claim the whole thing is a hoax. Others say this is the biggest crisis of our time, requiring immediate and extreme action. Bringing Americans together to address this challenge calls for open minds and open ears. Greg got an earful from a Republican and a Democrat who are on the front lines of the energy debate. Andy Karsner was an assistant secretary of energy in the second Bush administration. He's currently a managing partner at Emerson Collective, a social benefit organization founded by Lorene Powell Jobs, the widow of Steve Jobs. Tom Steyer is a hedge fund billionaire and president of NextGen Climate, a political organization that aims to prevent climate disaster while promoting prosperity for every American. Here's our conversation about climate, left, right, and center.
Andy Karsner, you were deeply involved in negotiations, climate negotiations in the second Bush administration. What's your assessment of the climate deal in Paris? Is it good for America?
Well, my first assessment is just one word, relief. You know, it's the end of a long, strange trip that began in the administration of George H.W. Bush in Rio almost a quarter century ago. I don't think anybody anticipated in Rio all that time ago that it would take almost a quarter century to get to some sort of uniform global consensus on the direction, the pace, and everybody rowing in the boat in the same direction for the same purpose. That's what Paris was, and it was important because Paris was the end no matter what. It was the final stop where we said, we can do this, or it meant a collapse of the process. That deal got done. But the Paris Agreement itself, if it were fully realized, would not get to half of what is needed. In other words, the end of negotiation needs to yield the beginning of demonstrable, measurable, potentially enforceable action that takes us onto a pathway and trajectory to realize the objectives.
Tom Steyer, what do you make as a businessman of the presence in Paris of Coca-Cola, Disney, General Electric? Corporate America was there and on board in Paris.
One of the big successes in Paris is that what I would think of as civil society really showed up. So that includes businesses. It includes nonprofits. It was basically a statement from a very broad group of important actors from around the world that they were going to be part of the solution here.
Andy Karsner, if corporate America is on board behind this, why doesn't Paris have more political support from the National Republican Party?
Well, there's so many different ways to divide that question. I mean, what National Republican political party would be my first, which brand, this week? But irrespective of current bizarre aberrations to the party of Lincoln, there is a lot of frustration in the way that technology and economy are separating people across communities in this country. And unfortunately, we have predatory figures on the political horizon that are preying on some of those fears and frustrations and in the worst cases, ignorance and bigotry. And most of the constituency base of the Republican Party, non-urban, middle-of-the-country places, have a more significant learning curve that needs to be climbed to embrace fact-based science and that we need to help them climb in all kinds of ways.
Tom Steyer?
Republican voters have moved on this. If you go around the country and ask Republicans, do you want the government to accelerate the move to clean energy, you get 75% of Republicans who want that. So it's not true that Republicans aren't up the learning curve. And they've moved pretty much in lockstep with American business. So as American business has actually come around to, we have to do it, we can do it, we can make money doing it, Republican voters have moved the exact same way.
So I agree with what you just said about their support and general favoritism towards clean energy. That, I think, is separate to their acceptance of climate science, right? So, you know, there's a reason why Texas leads in renewable energy, and yet Texas also is one of the most reticent states embracing climate science, precisely because if they can make money off the energy and it's a good technology, why not? You know, but the idea of doing something that induces greater acceleration towards policy, that's more challenging.
But if you ask in the toughest way, do you believe the climate is changing? Do you believe it is changing because of human activity? Do you believe that the government should be doing something about it? You still get in the mid-50s from Republicans. So the fact of the matter is, we have a majority of Republicans on this, but Republican elected officials are in a very different place on energy and climate than Republican voters. We have traditionally been a bipartisan country when it came to clean air, clean water, preserving our environment, handing on a country to our children and grandchildren that we were proud of. That has been traditionally a bipartisan, patriotic statement by both parties. But we are being held hostage by elected officials who are not actually representing the views of their own constituents, of their own party.
Listen, I put into place regulations to phase out incandescent lighting. And the same guys who voted for that in a bipartisan legislation with two-thirds of both houses of Congress later came out and said, you're not taking away my damn incandescent. You know, I cook an egg on that thing. I love my incandescent, you know. So all of a sudden, the whole four-gallon flush toilet crowd came out. You know, don't take away my flusher. I'll flush it three times. I'll go to Canada before you take away my flusher. But these people voted for this in a different political environment before they had to placate or run to the fringes and pursue illogical thinking for whatever keeps them employed through their fundraising mechanisms. Tom, I don't know. It's a sad evolution.
Tom Steyer, you've done some work with former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson, Mayor Michael Bloomberg, about the risk of climate. So tell us about that project and what's at risk to the American financial system and property.
So Mike Bloomberg, Hank Paulson, and I started a project called Risky Business to try and take a business approach to talk about the risks of not taking action on climate. Hank is a Republican, Mike is an independent, and I'm a Democrat, and we specifically wanted the project not to be partisan. And the idea was that we would do very rigorous studies of the impact of not acting and to see down to a community level, down to a zip code level, what the impact would be in terms of increased heat, rising seas, the impact on agriculture, so that everybody could look and see if you live in Des Moines, Iowa, what's the impact in Des Moines, Iowa on a business basis. And then have the messengers be business people to go out and say, actually, not making a decision is making a decision. And as I like to say, the one thing that the farmers in Minneapolis really want is a progressive Democrat from San Francisco to show up and tell them what to do. If you're going to speak to those people, you need a Greg Page, who's the former CEO of Cargill, which is a huge agricultural business based in Minneapolis, or a Hank Paulson, who's a Republican from Chicago, who they know in their bones cares about them. Someone who they trust and see as themselves can come out and present the information. And the idea is to be able to say to people, let's move beyond the emotion. Let's try and be as hard-headed as we can be and present the information objectively. And let's use that as a basis for making decisions. And the first study showed that not acting is a very dangerous thing. By 2100, if we don't act, it will reduce our GDP by 36%. It's not a minor thing. It's a gigantic thing. But what we also are going to want to show is what is the impact of actually taking on this challenge and moving to clean energy. So we're going to release another report which will show in the same way, down to the community level, what is the impact on jobs, wages, costs of accelerating a move to clean energy based on existing technologies. We see this as a huge American problem and a huge American opportunity. So I want the Andy Karsners of the world to be on our side. I want to be on his side. We will have to agree together how we're going to do it. You know, we won World War II. We won the Cold War. This will be something we will look back and say, didn't we do something great together? Because it's not going to happen unless we do it together.
Andy.
Ah.
I think it's a beautiful sentiment. And I always caution my own kids to have healthy skepticism and don't let it slide into cynicism. But at the same time, I'm basically thinking not just about the glory of what we can do and what we're capable of, but what the inescapable destination is if we don't act with some urgency in a manner that we're capable of now, and how the future will hold us to account.
We're talking about American politics and energy at Climate One. I'm Greg Dalton. My guests are the investor and climate advocate Tom Steyer and Andy Karsner, an energy expert. Andy Karsner, Detroit and Silicon Valley are kind of getting together now, coming together with electric cars, connected cars. How do you see that as a big disruption and job creator?
Well, I think it's huge. When I left office, there were approximately zero electric vehicles on the road. You know, now there is, I think, in excess of 17 different models on the road. And now we're not talking about those vehicles, one per driveway. Every kid's with testosterone is going to go rev one up and run the strip like when we were kids, you know, rev the motor. Now the kids are saying, well, you know, where the hell do I need that? I've got an on-demand chauffeur in my pocket. You know, I can drink as much as I want at the clubs, and I don't want a driver's license. So the licenses are going down. The models are changing. The ride-sharing and a collaborative economy is skyrocketing. The number of apps and innovation around the ecosystem of mobility. It's not about the car anymore as part of an American dream. It's about the ease and access of mobility on demand in the most environmentally sensitive way with the most efficient outcome. And it's going to happen with these wild-eyed dreamers and kids that are in Silicon Valley. And it's going to be a contagion because the ideas are too good.
But some people are being left behind. I want to talk about coal miners in Appalachia, loggers, etc. Andy Karsner, lots of jobs will be created. But if you're a 50-year-old coal miner, the U.S. coal industry is going away.
I think it's one of the most important under-addressed questions in all of this, right? In other words, as we're up here calling for better thinking, better policies, better technologies, faster implementation, go fast forward on a big meta and macro problem, we cannot lose sight of the real things that we have to deal with from the ground up in our homes, in our schools, in our communities. With the advent of the light bulb, we began in this country to aggressively and assertively pursue something called the social compact. That is, delivering electricity as a universal good to every American in every corner, in every community, to have access to light so that they could read at night, so that they could cool their food and store it longer, so that they could change the temperature and live in Florida or in the deserts of Phoenix or whatever. And we sort of take that for granted. We only finished it a quarter century ago. It was in my lifetime that the last homes in Arkansas were getting wired up, right? But we now are at the precipice of needing to revise all of that. We have a need to ensure that the social compact itself evolves so that it's beyond access to electricity, which we take for granted, and is access to all of the technologies that are available now to improve people's lives. There's no reason that all the homes in Atherton should have solar panels and Teslas in the driveways. And over in East Palo Alto, we have almost no solar panels. So that same seething problem of static income that has been plaguing us for two decades has a chance of being exacerbated if we don't mind the dislocations, not just at the mine mouth or at the wellheads, but also in our communities across this country, in East Palo Alto and Oakland and Detroit and Cleveland, et cetera. So we're going to pay a lot of attention to that.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about energy and politics at Climate One. Let's go to our audience question. Welcome.
Hey, Alden Meyer, Union of Concerned Scientists from Washington. I'm wondering about carbon pricing. The reality is we're spending $500 billion a year worldwide to subsidize consumption and production of fossil fuels. Can we eliminate that? Can we put a price on carbon to socialize the externalities? And could that be something where left and right could come together and say, let's use the market mechanisms for good?
Andy Karsner.
I believe the answer to that is yes, I think it's something you have to pursue. You know, in the essence and core of a Republican Party that believes in market-based solutions being the most powerful and prolific and transformative to the outcome society seeks. And in this case, there are so many good ideas floating. I was just reading one from Ted Halstead on a fee and dividend plan, which basically takes the Alaskan plan that yields a dividend for everybody who's a stakeholder in the oil economy and turns it on its head and says, let's give everybody who's a stakeholder anywhere a dividend based on what we collect from a progressively rising fee on the greenhouse gas emissions. Well, what could be more logical and more Republican than that? We need to fortify a marketplace that needs price signals to let the population act and participate and be entrepreneurs and free enterprise and consumers with their own discretionary basis, and that's going to require some sort of fee and dividend, some sort of tax that prices this externality.
Top that, Tom Steyer.
Well, I want to officially welcome Andy Karsner to the Democratic Party.
I wouldn't go that far.
Because the fact of the matter is, when you look at American politics, the Democratic Party is dying to put a price on carbon, is dying to price externalities, let the market act. And it's kind of like Friday night and we just want a date.
To be clear, being a Republican has been a big part of my identity. And George Shultz is a mentor of mine as one of the last living members of the Reagan cabinet. I consider myself a Reaganite. But I will tell you that part of being a Republican is conservation and caring for the environment and my admiration for Teddy Roosevelt. So we actually need a competition of ideas around the implementation of logical things. And that's what I'm sort of bemoaning.
We're talking about energy with Andy Karsner and Tom Steyer. Let's go to our next question. Welcome.
Mr. Steyer and Mr. Karsner, my question to you is around the field of advanced nuclear technologies, which has been spurred by Bill Gates' investment in TerraPower and Peter Thiel's in Transatomic. What do you think specifically about prospect investments from both the government standpoint as well as private initiative standpoint on the field of inherently safe advanced nuclear technologies?
Andy Karsner, nuclear power?
We have to scale all the renewables as fast as possible, but it's not going to be enough. And so if you really embrace the science, you've also got to do the math. And we can't do this without nuclear power. But we have the oldest fleet in the world, therefore we have the oldest cement in the world. We don't know how the containment vessels work at this age, and we have no plans for replacement, and we have no real logical R&D schedule to commit ourselves to the moral obligations we have, having unleashed the power to change the world from splitting the atom. And the very idea that this country is prepared to vacate the field and read our manuals in Chinese for the next century as we retire our reactor fleet without a serious effort to detoxify the end of the waste streams and apply ourselves with serious science and technology to reform and update something that cannot be undone. Pandora's box has been opened. The atom has been split. We now have to go the rest of the way and figure out how to make it benign and not adverse to our living or to those who people who might dig it up 150 years or 800 years from now. And we have the capacity to apply ourselves in that way. And I think we've got to be pursuing that without bias. So it's that next generation we need to be after and be after it aggressively.
Tom Steyer, many Democrats are ideologically opposed to nuclear. Should new nuclear be part of America's future?
I have looked at the next generation of nukes, including TerraPower. I've looked at a bunch of them. They don't produce greenhouse gases. And the whole point about the next generation is to see whether we can do it at a level that's cheap enough so it can compete in a safe way in producing commodity power. The experiments are ongoing. People are investing hundreds of millions of dollars, and they're hoping to build pilot plants and see what happens. But let me disagree strongly with something that Andy said. He said we can't do it without nuclear. That's not true. The fact of the matter is 98%+ of the new electricity generation in the United States in the first quarter was renewable. There are a lot of technologies out there that we're working on, including nuclear, but not limited to nuclear. We're going to be able to solve this, and we are not dependent on anyone of those solutions, definitely not including nuclear. And I think there's a very strong argument that the way we're going to do it is through renewables and storage.
Republican Andy Karsner and Democrat Tom Steyer have been discussing America's fractured attitude to the climate conundrum. We'd like to know what you think about climate politics. Find us on Facebook or join us on Twitter. Our handle is @ClimateOne. You're listening to Climate One with Greg Dalton. Welcome to Climate One with Greg Dalton. While national politicians are grandstanding over climate change, local politicians are brainstorming to come up with solutions. Along the West Coast, from California to Canada, local governments are taking the lead to support industry efforts to make the clean energy transition. One hotly debated approach is a carbon tax. Greg is now joined by three political leaders who are part of the West Coast Collaborative, a public-private partnership committed to developing clean air technologies. Kate Brown is governor of Oregon. She was previously their Secretary of State and served 17 years in the state legislature. Jay Inslee is governor of Washington State. He was a member of Congress for 15 years and served in the Clinton administration as regional director of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Mary Pollock is Minister of the Environment in British Columbia. She's been a member of the provincial legislature since 2005 and previously served as Minister of Transportation and Infrastructure. Here's our conversation about local solutions to the global climate crisis.
Governor Inslee, Washington is an agricultural state. So tell us how food and agriculture is a climate issue.
This is not an abstraction. This is not a graph. This is not a parts per million issue. I had to talk to oyster growers that have had to move their operations because of ocean acidification has made it impossible to breed some of the larvae. I look at farmers that worry about their water supplies because we had a good snowpack this year, but guess what? It's all melting off within 2 or 3 weeks, so we've got no irrigation. So when I think of climate change, I think of the faces that I have seen of people whose lives are being threatened by this emergency. So this is personal, it's real, it's here, and it demands an urgent response.
But we created this mess, so how do we deal with something that we've created and do it so quickly? Kate Brown?
Well, we're focused in Oregon in a number of areas, but primarily around coal and cars, because those are the two primary producers of greenhouse gas emissions in Oregon. And so we tackled cars by passing our low carbon fuel standard. And then we tackled coal over a period of time. 1997, we said we're not going to build any more coal-powered electricity generating plants in Oregon. And a few years ago, we agreed to shut down our only coal-powered electricity plant that will be shut down by 2020. And then most recently, I signed into law a bill that will move Oregon away from coal-generated electricity. We are the first state in the nation to do that. That bill also required that we move to 50% renewables by 2040. So I'm very proud. Oregon is not a huge part of the global problem. We're a small state. We only have 4 million people. But we can be part of the solution, and that's exactly what we're doing.
Minister Pollock, in some ways, British Columbia was out ahead of even California and Washington and Oregon in terms of putting a price on carbon pollution. And so far, I don't think it's trashed your economy. BC is still doing pretty well. Tell us how that worked out.
Our experience with having a revenue-neutral carbon tax is emissions are down and the economy is up. We have an economy in British Columbia that has been outperforming the rest of Canada, even through the 2008-2009 downturn. That was, by the way, when we brought in our carbon tax. You might think we're crazy for instituting a new tax when you have an economic downturn. But the evidence now is pretty overwhelming that it not only dropped our petroleum consumption across all fuel types, but we believe it actually strengthened our economy. Every dollar of our carbon tax is returned to British Columbians in either direct tax reductions or, in the case of low-income people, direct rebate checks to them. So you're constantly recirculating these dollars back into the economy, giving people the ability to make their own choices.
A lot of the time that British Columbia was doing that, there was a national government in Canada, the Harper government, that left the Kyoto Protocol that was very pro-fossil fuels and hostile to climate action. So how did BC move forward when the national conversation was very different?
It was very difficult. We now are joined by some fantastic partners in the world of carbon pricing in provinces like Ontario, Quebec, Alberta. They're still not as broad or as high as ours. Ours is about $30 Canadian a ton. That would equate to about 20 cents US on a gallon of gas, for example. Now we have our federal government leading the development of a pan-Canadian framework, and Thankfully, one of the working groups they have is a working group on a national carbon price. So we're finally seeing a federal government that really wants to partner on climate action.
Governor Inslee, you served in Congress 15 years. It's a very different situation in the United States and Washington, where climate is basically highly politicized. So how can states and cities move forward when it's kind of a toxic debate at the national level?
the people of Washington State want us to respond to this challenge. And the reason is they understand the health of their children at risk, not just the polar bears. So we have a program that helps people get affordable electric cars. We have a program that builds electric infrastructure. We have a system that has helped integrate grid-scale storage so we can integrate renewable resources in our grid. And we are also tackling transportation fuels. So we will have a grid in the next 4 years that is 90% free of fossil fuels.
And you're going around a hostile legislature, and similar to what President Obama is doing.
I wouldn't say going around. We're simply implementing the legislation that was adopted but never implemented by the legislature itself. And it's entirely consistent with our existing clean air responsibilities.
Governor Brown, can Oregon and other places grow their economy while also getting cleaner? Does that come at the expense of, I don't know, loggers or other people in your state?
Bloomberg just ranked Oregon as the fastest growing economy in the United States. I know Governor Inslee may disagree with that ranking, but we're doing well. And our green, clean technology jobs are part of that. They're growing at a rate of 11%, substantially faster than other sectors. The key is innovation, and Oregon has seen fit to invest in innovative practices that will ensure that the economy thrives and that our environment is cleaner.
Mary Pollack, there's a lot of fossil fuels in the interior of North America that wants to get out to market in Asia. There's a proposed liquid natural gas port in British Columbia, and some climate scientists recently wrote to the government of Canada saying, please don't do this $36 billion investment. And you wrote back and said they're not connected to reality.
Science is only as good as the assumptions that you put into your analysis. And in this case, their assumptions were based on the unmitigated emissions from that plant. So they were basing their conclusions on a profile that would have seen this plant become the single largest emitter in all of Canada. However, there are many things you can do to reduce emissions in terms of a liquefied natural gas project, not just at the plant level, but also in the upstream and in production. And we now have put in place a benchmark for intensity of CO2 in production at the lowest rate of any other production facility in the world. And natural gas used in the right circumstances can have a significant impact in cleaning up not just emissions, but also, of course, particulate matter and other things that concern us around the health of populations in places like Beijing and other areas of the world where there are people who are dying because they don't have clean air.
Governor Inslee, do you support natural gas and liquefied natural gas?
I do think that we have to be very cautious on natural gas and the methane emissions associated with their production. I don't have full confidence yet that we really know that issue. We got to understand that before we do consider it a transitional fuel is the way I would look at it.
We had Lou Alstadt, former executive vice president of ExxonMobil, here recently, and he agreed that the industry does not have a handle on methane emissions.
Yep,
that's and correct. That's an ExxonMobil executive. Governor Brown, a lot of people who are against fracking think that the natural gas could be worse than coal in some cases.
It's certainly a gray area. We need more data. In terms of the global issue, it has to be part of the solution.
We're talking about clean energy at Climate One. Our guests today are Kate Brown, governor of Oregon, Jay Inslee is governor of Washington, and Mary Pollack is minister of the environment in British Columbia. I'm Greg Dalton. Governor Inslee, coal ports, there's a lot of them proposed along the West Coast. Some of them have been rejected. Some of them have been pulled. Where does that stand, and do you support building coal ports, which could develop jobs in Seattle and the port areas of Washington?
Well, the first thing we support is eliminating our dependence on coal in our grid, which we are doing. So we're shutting down our own coal plant in a few years. We just had legislation that will allow us to shutter two plants in Montana that are feeding us coal-based electricity. We want to have a state free from coal. We're moving in that direction. On the coal port issue, in our environmental protection system of permitting, we are insisting on evaluating the carbon emissions of the coal wherever it is burned. Because frankly, it doesn't matter where you burn it, the carbon dioxide from that coal ends up in my backyard and in Puget Sound, which makes it difficult to grow oysters. So as part of our local permitting process, we are insisting applicants assess what the carbon pollution global ramifications are of burning that coal. And some of the proponents don't like that, but I think it's a fair thing.
Governor Inslee, how could you get green mobility, address traffic jams in Washington while also having greener, lower carbon mobility?
You can increase mobility and reduce carbon pollution at the same time. They are not enemies. They are mutually tied at the hip. So when you provide bus transit for people, first off, they love it. Every bus we put on, it's full the next morning because people love the service they're getting. And this actually matters some pride. We passed not only the largest transportation package in our state's history, but the greenest transportation package with the heaviest percentage attributable to light rail. We're going to build a light rail system, we hope, from Everett to Tacoma. Bike lanes, HOV, rapid transit bus. We put on a light rail system, a new station. It's right in front of the University of Washington football stadium where you can see the Huskies beat the Ducks. So the word is that people love public transport. They use it. At the same time, you're reducing carbon pollution.
Let's go to our audience questions at Climate One. Welcome.
Bob Archer, Citizens Climate Lobby. Thank you to British Columbia for demonstrating the transparency, effectiveness, and predictability of a revenue-neutral carbon tax. My question is for Governor Brown and Governor Inslee. If in the next Congress, the Republicans introduce a sound revenue-neutral carbon tax, would you in principle endorse that?
That's a
the revenue neutrality characteristic.
I think in terms of carbon policy, that if we can get a national policy that will incent and motivate us to reduce greenhouse gas emission reductions, then that is a good thing.
So unfortunately, I've got to be a truth teller here, and sometimes that's a hard job. There is zero chance of that particular party being a productive proponent of any policies because they are captured by those that deny the clear science of this. And as long as they deny the clear science of that, it's impossible for them at the moment to be productive partners. So unfortunately, I don't think that's going to happen.
Mary Pollock?
Could I just say, from British Columbia's standpoint, obviously, whatever initiatives your own jurisdiction undertakes, you think they're the best. But our interest is not in seeing everyone adopt the same type of carbon price we have. Let a million flowers bloom. However you do that, cap and trade, direct carbon tax, revenue neutral, not revenue neutral, you know, we see that as up to jurisdictions
just
themselves.
Put a price on pollution. Governor Brown?
And if I can add, one of the reasons I enjoy working at the state level is because we are able to implement innovative, creative public policies. The states are truly the petri dishes to move us forward, and that's why we've worked together through the Pacific Coast Collaborative.
Governor Inslee, where can Republicans and Democrats agree? Is it on forest fires? There are 10 Republicans who, when Pope Francis came to America last year, came out and said there ought to be some action on climate. So they're not all of one mind. Where can Republicans and Democrats work together?
I have been awaiting the arrival of a Republican leader who will stand up and say that my party, the Grand Old Party, stands for recognition of clear science and common sense solutions that grow rather than shrink our economy. And I keep hoping, and we keep extending our hands of friendship to come discuss solutions. But the problem is that the Republican elected officials refuse, by and large, 95% of them, to say there's even a problem that we can deal with.
Kate Brown?
To be fair, in Oregon, we've worked really hard across the aisle with Republicans and Democrats over the years to make sure that Oregon is meeting its greenhouse gas emission reduction goals. And we did get bipartisan support on our coal to clean legislation. And I am hoping, moving forward, that we will get bipartisan support on a transportation package that invests in mass transit in a way that will continue to help Oregon meet our goals. And I am excited about the opportunity to do that. And I know Governor Inslee had bipartisan support on his transportation package that moved us in the right direction as well.
Let's go to our next audience question.
Hi, my name is Matt. This question is for Governor Inslee. There is a division among the labor bloc and the environmental bloc of the state legislature here in California. You know, the labor bloc is concerned that the environmental policies are costing jobs. I'm wondering if you're seeing that type of thing in Washington, and if so, how you address that.
You know, we've enjoyed a very successful blue-green alliance, and I think one of the reasons is we have such a robust clean energy economy that are putting thousands of people to work. And by the way, it's not just in Seattle. Everybody knows Seattle's doing pretty well. But, you know, where's the largest manufacturer of carbon fiber that goes into electric cars? It's in Moses Lake, Washington, in eastern Washington. And also, our labor community understands that climate change is a job killer, okay? Climate change is killing employment in my state. The forest product industry, when those forests burn down, we don't take a lot of lumber out of them, okay? The fishing industry is on the block for damage due to ocean acidification. So our labor community understands that.
Let's go to our last question. Welcome.
Hi, this is directed to Minister Pollock. I don't know if you are aware of this. North Vancouver, the city of North Vancouver, passed a law to require a climate risk disclosure label on gas pumps. Do you see that strategy spreading throughout BC? And in general, do you, all of you in the panel, do you think that it's time for oil companies to disclose the risks of climate change to consumers of gasoline? And most of us consume it on a regular basis, and we can't see the external costs that are inherent in the consumption of the fuel.
Thank you. Minister Pollock, gasoline pump disclosure.
Yeah, I am aware of it, and there is interest, I know, being expressed by other communities across British Columbia. I think anything that you can do to have people understand the direct connection between activities in their life and how that might contribute to climate change is important to do. It is way too easy for us to focus just on big industry and not to realize how the choices we make every day in our lives are impacting on climate.
Kate Brown.
Each one of us can make a difference. Each one of us should be, and we need to work together to move not only the West Coast, but the entire world forward.
Greg Dalton has been discussing the role of local politics in the race for climate solutions. We heard from Oregon Governor Kate Brown, Washington Governor Jay Inslee, and Mary Pollock, Minister of the Environment in British Columbia. Free podcasts of all our Climate One conversations are available on our website, climateone.org. You'll also find video clips, photos, and more. Please join us next time for another Climate One discussion about powering America's future. Climate One is a sustainability initiative at the Commonwealth Club of California. Greg Dalton is our executive producer and host. Jane Ann Chen is the producer. Kelly Pennington directs our audience engagement. Carrie Halperin is director of content. The audio engineer is William Bloom. I'm Claire Schoen, the editor. The Commonwealth Club CEO is Dr. Gloria Duffy. Climate One is presented in association with KQED Public Radio.